This recording is provided by the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people with visual, physical, learning, language, or other disabilities and conditions that prevent them from reading printed materials.
Welcome to Book Reviews. Each week, we read reviews from a variety of local and national book reviewers to help you find the best in new releases. So sit back and get ready to plan your next read with Book Reviews right here on your audio reading service.
Welcome. This is Book Reviews, and I'm your reader, Marcia, with the audio reading service of the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today, I'll be reading from the Journal Gazette, the New York Times Book Reviews, and also Kirkus Book Reviews. And now I'll begin with the Journal Gazette, copyright 2026. The date is Saturday, July the 11th, entitled Books. And we begin today with the article, a full-page article, is entitled Sydney Sense. Tagline, Espionage Insights Propel Narrative in Ex-Agent's Latest, by Eric Pedersen. James Wolfe is not his real name, but the former spy who writes under that nom de plume is the author of Spies and Other Gods, a splendid mystery set in the world of espionage. It's got a unique way of telling its story, which we won't spoil, and characters who are unexpectedly more than you would first imagine. Wolfe agreed to answer our questions and left his encoded responses at a secret dead drop location. Or did he? We'll begin with the first question. It says, please tell readers about your new book, Spies and Other Gods. Wolfe, the seed of the idea for Spies and Other Gods lies in an official report written by the UK Parliamentary Committee that oversees the spy agencies. In this report, the committee complained that spy chiefs were blocking their staff from whistleblowing directly to this committee, instead forcing them to make their complaints through internal channels. This started me thinking along two lines. The first was that spies can be extremely obstructive and unhelpful. The second was a question. What would complaint number one look like? From there, my story took me to an Iranian assassin, an international manhunt, and an awful lot of dark secrets. The next question? You worked in intelligence, as have other authors in your genre. Why do you think former intelligence officers write books, and do you all get together in an undisclosed location and compare notes? Wolfe, great question. I wish I could give you a definitive answer. For me, the answer lies in the way that spying is all about character, psychology, and motive, which are things that preoccupy fiction writers too. Spies are natural observers, natural watchers. They like to collect details that allow them to build up a profile of an individual. As for the secret meetings with other spies turned authors in an undisclosed location, I cannot possibly comment. Question, a follow-up. You write, anyone who chooses writing spy novels over spying can't have been much good in the first place, and I'd love to hear more about that. Well, I'm sure it's a winking joke. If you have more to add on that subject, that would be great. Wolfe, I'm really just poking fun at myself with this line. There's a lot of myth-making in spy literature, and there are a lot of people in the spy world itself who take themselves just a little bit seriously. I want people to read this book because they enjoy the writing, the characters, and the humor, not because they think it was written by a super spy. Question? Without giving anything away, you have a unique approach to how you tell the story. Is there a way that you can talk about that? Wolfe, I've been preoccupied for a while now with the idea of collective identities. In an organization like M15 or M16, you have all the thousands of employees with their separate identities, and then above them all, floating like a kind of a deity, is the organization's identity. So often it's hard to pin down responsibility for a decision or a policy to one individual, because the truth is that the decision has been taken collectively by this super identity. I thought it would be interesting to write a novel with the organization itself providing the narrative voice, in this case a voice that is spiky, provocative, argumentative, defensive, cynical, and I hope lots of fun. Next question. What are you reading now? Wolf, I'm reading Lonesome Dove, which is every bit as gripping as I was led to believe. I've always loved Cormac McCarthy's westerns, like Blood Meridian, and it's been so interesting to see the same landscape from a different perspective. It's also made me very glad that I was not born into that exceptionally violent and brutal world. Question: is there a book or type of book that you are reluctant to read? Wolf, I hate to admit it, but I very rarely read spy novels. It might be that I spent 15 years as a spy, which gives me a low tolerance for unrealistic scenarios, or that writing my own spy novels means that I am desperate for a palate cleanser at the end of the day. There are spy novels I love, like Harlot's Ghost, The Quiet American, or The Untouchable, but it's not my genre of choice. Question: is there a person who made an impact on your reading life? A teacher? A parent? A librarian? Or maybe someone else? Wolf, I remember an English teacher when I was age about 12, and a lesson in which we were going around the class reading our essays aloud. Mine was pretty unremarkable about something or other, but I still remember the way the teacher stopped me and asked me to reread a sentence, and then said that the essay was worth it for that one sentence on its very own. I realized that in that moment that a sentence can be a thing of beauty. Question: what do you find the most appealing in a book? The plot? The language? The cover? A recommendation? Do you have any examples? Wolf, when Henry James was asked about his books, he replied that his objective was to write interesting things in one beautiful sentence after another. I can't think of a better way of putting it. I love words, a distinctive style, a writer who knows what they're doing and has interesting things to say along the way. And that review has been on the book that's entitled Spies and Other Gods. The author, James Wolfe. It's an Atlantic Crime publication, 267 pages, and sells for $27. Next on this very same page in the Journal Gazette is the featured piece on six brand new library books. And these are all works on new love and connection, and they're newly available at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. The first one is entitled, How to Feel Loved, The Five Mindsets That Get You More of What Matters Most, by Sanja Libromisky and Harry Reese. Challenging the belief that love depends on trying to appear appealing, five relationship mindsets show how vulnerability, curiosity, attentive listening, and mutual openness can deepen feelings of connection. That book again is entitled How to Feel Loved, The Five Mindsets That Get You More of What Matters Most by Sanja Libromisky and Harry Reese. The next book is entitled The Balancing Act, Creating Healthy Dependency and Connection Without Losing Yourself, by Nedra Glover Tawab. Drawing on attachment theory and therapeutic tools, the guide explores how to maintain intimacy, community, and interdependence without sacrificing personal identity or healthy boundaries. That book, again, is entitled The Balancing Act, Creating Healthy Dependency and Connection Without Losing Yourself, authored by Nedra Glover Tawab. Our next book is entitled Smitten, Romantic Obsession, The Neuroscience of Limerence and How to Make Love Last by Tom Bellamy. Bellamy explores the neuroscience behind limerence, explaining how infatuation develops, distinguishing it from healthy romantic love, and outlining strategies for breaking unhealthy fixation while building lasting relationships. That book again is entitled Smitten, Romantic Obsession, The Neuroscience of Limerence and How to Make Love Last, authored by Tom Bellamy. Our next featured book, The Intimate Animal, The Science of Sex, Fidelity, and Why We Live and Die for Love, by Justin R. Garcia. This work examines how evolutionary biology, psychology, culture, and technology shape intimacy, attraction, and fidelity while investigating the competing human drives for emotional attachment and sexual novelty. That book is entitled The Intimate Animal, The Science of Sex, Fidelity, and Why We Live and Die for Love by Justin R. Garcia. The next book is entitled The Cost of Quiet, How to Have the Hard Conversations That Create Secure, Lasting Love, by Colette Jane Fear, Fear argues that conflict avoidance and emotional silence gradually erode relationships, then shows how attachment science and evidence-based communication strategies help couples to address conflict with honesty and strengthen lasting bonds. That book is entitled The Cost of Quiet, How to Have the Hard Conversations That Create Secure, Lasting Love by Colette Jane Fear. And the last book in this article is entitled Bonded by Evolution, The New Science of Love and Connection, authored by Paul Eastwick. Drawing on research to challenge common assumptions about attraction, Eastwick argues that enduring relationships emerge from compatibility, attachment, and shared experiences rather than initial desirability. That book again is entitled Bonded by Evolution, The New Science of Love and Connection, and it's authored by Paul Eastwick. And now I'm reading from the New York Times Book Reviews, from the New York Times, copyright 2026 of the New York Times Company. And I'm going to begin with new historical fiction books. And the very first one we'll be highlighting today is entitled 5 Weeks in the Country, the author Francine Prose. Two famous writers, one desperate for any sort of kindred connection, the other desperate to escape his wife and 9 children, put them all in a mansion in rural England and wait for the neurotic implosion. That's what Prose does in 5 Weeks in the Country, by Harper, 287 pages and $30, with irresistibly tragicomic results. It's inspired by the real-life visit of Hans Christian Andersen to Charles and Catherine Dickens in the spring of 1857. Prose's novel uses the tension-filled siege between guest and host to probe the demise of the Dickens marriage. Cleverly approaching her subject from different perspectives, Prose starts off with the group voice of the Dickens children. It is always painful losing a parent's love, but it was worse when your father was the most beloved father in England. And then we shift to an omnipotent view of Dickens, chafing at his responsibilities and succumbing to a delusional infatuation with the actress Ellen Terran, young enough to be his daughter yet bearing an uncanny resemblance to his adored sister-in-law, long dead but never forgotten. Finally picking up the narrative is Andersen, a lonely bachelor who has been feeling less welcome among those who has found his itinerant life in Denmark. As he struggles to reconcile Dickens' vernacular public persona with a tyrant fomenting public-private misery, Andersen realizes that his own peculiarities are part of the problem. Once again, I was Hans, the awkward, isolated boy, the eccentric guest, the burden, the sacrificial lamb, reduced to a household pest. And yet he stays on, reluctant to shed the dream of belonging to a family, even a family as wretched as this particular one. Moving on to a book that's entitled The Foursome by Christina Baker Klein. Klein has set herself a formidable task in The Foursome, in which she attempts to move beyond the singular strangeness of the marriage that bound her distant cousins Sarah and Adeline Yates to the co-joined Siamese twins Chang and Eng, who brainstormed across 19th century America and Europe, but made their home in the foothills of North Carolina. Her success can be attributed to her choice of narrator, the initially reluctant, always questioning Sarah, whose guilt-ridden relationship with the impetuous Adeline will lead each woman to be tied to a shadow husband for over 30 years. Perhaps inevitably they become more than sisters and less than friends. That book is entitled The Foursome, and again, the author for that particular one is Christina Baker Klein. Our next book's description says the resurrection of country music's ultimate vanishing act. Gary Stewart spent a few years on top, but was largely forgotten after his tragic death in 2003. Now a new generation is rediscovering the one-time king of honky-tonk. In the summer of 1976, as America marked its bicentennial and break with the British monarchy, Gary Stewart was celebrating his own coronation. Crowned by Time magazine as the king of honky-tonk music, Stewart had earned his regal sobriquet with a run of classic country songs about loving, cheating, drinking, and dying. Stewart's reign at the top would be relatively brief, a half-decade of hits, interspersed with headlines about his drug busts and record label battles. His self-destructive streak helped turn him into a vanishing act. By the early 2000s, Stewart was far from fame, holed up in a double-wide trailer in his hometown of Fort Pierce, Florida, consumed by addiction and personal tragedy. He had already lost his son to suicide when, in late 2003, his wife of 42 years, Mary Lou, died very unexpectedly. A grief-stricken Stewart took his own life just a few weeks later. He was 59. In the aftermath, there would be no tribute albums, lavish reissues, or reputation-burnishing documentaries. Outside of a small devoted cult, Stewart became a faded figure. However, this year, Stewart's profile received its biggest boost since his hit-making heyday, thanks to the publication of I Am From the Honky Tonks, a definitive biography by the author Jimmy McDowell. The reissue label Delmore Recording Society follows with the first deep dive into Stewart's archives with One Track Mind, a collection of previously unreleased songwriting demos. That activity comes as a group of notable young country stars, the Billboard chart topper Ella Langley, the Country Music Association's Male Vocalist of the Year, Cody Johnson, and the Grammy winner Zach Topp, among them, have been covering Stewart's songs, singing his praises, and exposing his music to a new generation of fans. "There's something so raw about Gary Stewart," Topp said in an interview. "Every syllable he sings, he makes you feel it. His music is not for everyone, but the ones that do connect with it, they are hardcore." "Gary touches a nerve in people," said McDonough, who spent four decades chasing the stories of Stewart's life. "You become obsessed. That's what happened to me and to a lot of others who have heard his music." For those who knew him best, like Tanya Tucker, his friend, collaborator, and a Country Music Hall of Famer, the idea of a Gary Stewart revival in 2026 brings a lot of joy. "Some people are just too precious for this life," Tucker said. "Gary was one of them. He never got his due while he was here, but maybe his time has finally come." "You have to understand," said Stewart's daughter, Shannon Royce Ashburn, "my dad ate, slept, and breathed music." As Ashburn recalled in a recent interview, life in the Stewart home was less than conventional. "My poor mom couldn't even have a living room or a dining room. Basically, our house was filled with Dad's record collection, thousands of albums, and all these guitars and amplifiers. It was just music, music, music all the time." Born in Letcher County, Kentucky, in 1943, Stewart was the oldest of 12 children. In the late 50s, the family fled the coal mining camps of Appalachia, seeking opportunities of Florida's Treasure Coast. Stewart's father, George, was a cockfighter, while his mother, Georgia, sold Avon products and some illicit substances on the side. Stewart was just 16, a high school dropout, playing a rockabilly band called the Tomcats, when he met Mary Lou Taylor, 5 years his senior. The attraction was instant, and the couple married soon after, a passionate, tempestuous union that would last the rest of their lives. A natural-born musician with a flowing style on piano and guitar, Stewart would gig and tour with a series of bands throughout the mid-1960s, playing rock, pop, R&B, and blue-eyed soul. But he found his calling writing and singing country. In 1965, at the urging of his fellow Floridian and country singer-songwriter Mel Tillis, Stewart and his partner Bill Eldridge struck out for Nashville. They quickly found success as Music City tunesmiths, getting their songs cut by the likes of Hank Snow and Cal Smith, but it would take Stewart another decade to reestablish himself as a solo artist, landing a string of hits in the mid-70s. He has once memorably described a country song as a 3-minute soap opera, and signature sides like Drinking Thing, She's Actin' Single, I'm Drinking Doubles, and In Some Room Above the Street illustrated his point. These short, sharp musical melodramas, delivered in a high-striking vibrato, cut through the era's placid country pop to make their way to the top of the charts. Through the back half of the 70s, Stewart found success and also a diverse group of admirers, including Bob Dylan, the Allman Brothers, Waylon Jennings, and The Clash. But after a few years, the hits suddenly dried up. His label, RCA, tried teaming Stewart with the up-and-coming singer-songwriter Dean Dillon for a pair of duet albums. When that failed to reignite his career, Stewart was dropped by the label in 1983. One writer's obsession. About that same time, McDonald caught one of Stewart's rare New York City appearances at the Lone Star Cafe. McDonough went from expecting some pompadoured song salesman in a nudie suit, replicating his radio hits, but instead the concert proved a revelation. In addition to his honky-tonk stuff, the guy could pound the piano like Jerry Lee Lewis, play stinging southern rock like the Allmans, croon a ballad like Bobby Darin, and play an acoustic blues that would have Tommy Johnson nodding his head. McDonough said, "It actually just blew me away." At the time, McDonough was working as a sound editor for films, but seeing Stewart redirected his life. He spent the next few years chasing down the singer, who had abandoned his career and disappeared into Fort Pierce, where he was living a hermetic, hedonistic existence. Determined to drag Stewart back into the spotlight, McDonough finally pinned him down in 1987 and spent 10 days and nights interviewing him at his home. Over the course of intense conversations and occasional fights, Stewart was fond of hurling knives in McDonough's direction. The pair formed a strange, profound kinship. The experience formed the basis of a lengthy Stewart profile published in the Village Voice in 1988, kick-starting McDonough's writing career. The story also revived Stewart's fortunes as he made a comeback and cut a trio of albums for the California indie roots label High Tone Records before retreating once again. McDonough would go on to write acclaimed gonzo biographies of other artists, including the mercurial Canadian rocker Neil Young, the exploitation film star Russ Meyer, and the enigmatic soul singer Al Green. But he could not shake his Stewart obsession and eventually inevitably returned to the subject. "It took years to get to the bottom of Gary's life," McDonough said, "as much as anyone could ever get to the bottom of that guy." In his 542-page I Am From the Honky Tonks, largely succeeds in that effort, unpacking the reasons that Stewart fell off the charts and out of favor with the Nashville establishment so dramatically in the early 80s. RCA wanted him to keep turning out those drinking songs that had been his hits, but Gary got bored easily and wasn't going to do the same thing over and over again. Injuries sustained in a serious car accident in 1980 led to Stewart's addiction to painkillers. Add to that his utter indifference to success. "He genuinely did not give a damn about money or fame," McDonough said. "The music industry did not know what to do with someone like that." The narrative takes a darker turn during the final years of Stewart's life, at which point he was down to playing the occasional money gig on a circuit of Texas dance halls and Native American reservations, where he remained a popular attraction. Following the death of their troubled son, Joey, in 1988, both Stewart and his wife, Mary Lou, fell deeper into pills as a way of coping. Mary Lou died in her sleep in the late 2003, possibly from a heart attack, likely exacerbated by her drug use, though no autopsy was performed and Stewart was inconsolable. "We all tried to cheer him up as much as we could," recalled Tanya Tucker. "I told Gary, we'll get some pals together and we'll go away and we'll write. We'll write an album of songs and dedicate them all to Lou." But he was already gone in a way. Stewart's last performance was in December 2003 at a local bar called Pineapple Joe's. He joined the house band for a couple Jimmy Reed and Elvis Presley covers before delivering a haunting version of his own "An Empty Glass." "Somehow I'll make it home and cry myself to sleep," he sang, "and that's how my day ends every night for me." And 10 days later, Stewart was found in his trailer, dead from a self-inflicted shotgun wound. Inspiring a new generation. In an era where even the work of minor artists is endlessly eulogized and repackaged, Stewart's catalog remains largely untouched. Sony Music, which owns Stewart's RCA material, put out a best-of compilation just after his death, but nothing since. Even now, half of Stewart's albums for the label, including Little Jr., 1978, Gary, 1979, and Cactus and a Rose, 1980, are out of print and unavailable digitally. "And there's tons of other incredible stuff just sitting in the RCA vaults that no one has ever heard," said Mark Lynn, owner of the Nashville-based label Delmore Recording Society. In cooperation with Stewart's daughter, Lynn is hoping to fill the void by releasing some of his pre-RCA recordings, starting with the new One Track Mind, a 20-track set, chronicling his songwriting efforts from 1967 to 1971. Even on those demos, never intended for public consumption, Stewart delivers each song as if his very life depended on the performance. Gary looked at any recording as something for posterity. It did not matter if he was cutting in a big professional studio or sitting in his trailer singing into my tape recorder. His thing was, you're going to remember the song for the rest of your life. That band of artistic intensity has attracted a legion of fans to Stewart's work in recent years. Gary Stewart made serious music, said the contemporary honky-tonk singer Charlie Crockett. In terms of his themes, it's real music for adults, and that's maybe what has been missing from our country. The interest in Stewart's music has even begun to transcend the country realm. The North Carolina indie rock band Wednesday recorded a crunchy, noisy cover of She's Actin' Single, I'm Drinkin' Doubles that's become a staple of their live shows. Gary wrote some of the best songs of all time, said Wednesday frontwoman Carly Hartzman. You had to dig a little bit to find them, so ultimately covering them feels like discovering buried treasure and then throwing all the doubloons to the audience. Recently, Hartzman sent McDonough a video from a Wednesday concert in Sydney, Australia, where young people in a sold-out venue were dancing and singing along to Stewart's song. To think that Gary's music is crossing over to other generations and other hemispheres, McDonough said, chuckling, he would have been over the moon with that. Ashburn said, it just goes to show you how ahead of his time he really was. Dad would be so thrilled that he's still touching people's lives through his music, his daughter said. That's all he ever really wanted. And again, that particular book is entitled I Am From the Honky Tonks, authored by McDonough. And now we're actually out of time. That's all the time that we have for today. And this has been Marcia with Book Reviews. I hope that you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library.